Speaks. It's good to have them with us today. Their little son Austin had surgery last week up at Chapel Hill, and they're already back home from that. And Austin was the one who got up and walked out a minute ago. So he decided he wanted to be heard a little bit, and April took him out. But they wanted to express to all of you, their church family, their gratitude for your many prayers and phone calls and cards and all that went along with the surgery that Austin was having. That's a tough time for a parent to see an infant having surgery and all, but everything has worked out great. Austin's back home and doing fantastic. We're in week 23 of the story, where we're going through and seeing this seamless story from beginning to end of how God has laid out this beautiful story of redemption for us. Last week, I want to thank Greg Webb, the other Greg, for preaching for us. I've realized something here recently. It depends on who you're talking to, who the other Greg is. If you're talking to an adult, he's the other Greg. If you talk to a child, I'm the other Greg. So it just depends on which perspective. It was during Upward Basketball, I walked out to speak to some of the kindergarten kids that were playing, and their coach said, "Now, Mr. Greg wants to tell y'all something." And I got through, and Gigi Taylor's little boy, Braden, he did his hands up. He says, "I never knew there were two Gregs." And so so you know that now, and just whichever one, I'm the other Greg, or Greg, whichever way is fine with me. And Greg started us off on this new part of our story, the journey, where we've moved into the New Testament, where Jesus was born. And wow, what a story. The story of the birth of Christ that fits inside of the big story. What a great story. But let's be honest, we wouldn't have arrived the way Jesus did. That's not the way we would have come into this world. We would have come in with a little more glitz and glamour, a little more noise about it. We'd have had the red carpet rolled out like they do at the Oscar Awards and all of that. We'd have had trumpets blowing. We'd have been announcing it to the world that we had arrived. You know, and the way you arrive does say a lot about you and about what you're up to. And Jesus came into this world as a very humble servant. He came as in a way that said to all of mankind, "I've come to serve." It said to all mankind, "I'm not just here for the rich and the famous. I'm here for everybody." He said the solution to this is not going to be military power or political clout, popularity or beauty or anything else. The answer is going to be found in a sacrificial lamb. So it says a lot about how we arrive. And what we're going to talk about today is in the weeks following Jesus beginning his adult ministry. And we're going to look and see that there are certain events, certain occasions that take place in a person's life that signify a new beginning, beginning again. You know, you think about graduations. When you have a graduation that says to the world, "I'm completed something and I'm beginning with something else. I'm starting off with something now." Inaugurations. You know, you're not the president until you're inaugurated. The election may be in November, and you're voted in, elected, but you're not president until January when they have the inauguration. Weddings are the same way. You know, it is saying, "I have started something new. There's a change. I'm making a statement in my life." Frank Sinatra said, "A man doesn't know what happiness is until he's married, and then it's too late." I don't know what he meant, but I just share that with you. I don't know what he meant by that. But we're going to look... We're going to look at a couple of events early in Jesus' ministry that made a statement, that were drawing a line in the sand, bold statements that determined where he was going. We're going to look first in Matthew chapter 3. The scriptures will be on the screen, but if you want to turn there, please feel free to. Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 through 17. "Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, 'I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?' Jesus replied, 'Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness.' Then John consented. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water, and at that moment heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, 'This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased.'" I want to look at this event and see that Jesus was saying, among other things, but I think it was an event saying that Jesus was obedient, that I'm going to be obedient. John the Baptist had it right, as far as I'm concerned. If it was me, John the Baptist saying, hey, Jesus, this is backwards. You've got me to baptize you. You should be baptizing me. Now, I understand what John is saying. It would be like me saying to Jeff Gordon or Tony Stewart or one of those champion drivers to Meadtown to tell him, give him driving tips. It would be like me walking over to Mary Lane at the piano and say, now you'd be better to play it this way. It'd be like going up to Andy Griffin and saying, if you do this with your barbecue. You know, it's just backwards. It's not right for me to tell them these things. And John feels that way. So why did Jesus insist that John baptize him? He tells us, look at that verse again. Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness. You know, we make obedience so difficult when Jesus makes it so simple. He just says, obey God. Do what he says. Do what God says. Here Jesus was setting a tone right off the bat, right out of the blocks. He was sending a message. I am part of the plan. I'm going to follow the plan. Yes, I am the most significant part of the plan, but I'm not so great that I do not have to be obedient. And I choose to obey the Father. He was saying saying so much about what he was going to do. Jesus determined who he was going to be in life before he determined what he was going to do in life. And that's great advice for us. Determine who you're going to be in life before you determine what you're going to do in life. Great advice. There's another event that comes along here. Matthew 4, if you want to turn over to the next chapter. Matthew 4, verses 1 through 11 says this. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, if you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. Jesus answered, it is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you are the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. Jesus answered him, it is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Jesus said to him, away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Then the devil left him, and the angels came and attended him. Second bold statement I think that Jesus is making here is that I trust God. Jesus was saying, I will trust the Father. How did he trust? Well, the first thing he did was he went out in the wilderness for 40 days. How many of us would do that? How many of us would go out into the desert knowing out in the wilderness, away from everything and everyone, to be tested, knowing it was a bad day coming? It's going to be unpleasant. It's going to be uncomfortable. Would we give him 40 days? Would he give him a week of that? Would we give him 40 minutes a day? 40 minutes a week? Jesus showed that he was going to trust the Father by putting himself into that situation. Three temptations are listed. I'm convinced that there were probably more. It's just these three are listed. But no matter which temptations they are or how many they are, it doesn't matter because Jesus had a theme. Jesus had a conviction. I will trust the Father. No matter what temptation came along, I'm going to trust God. Did Satan think he was just going to have a rematch, a repeat of what happened in the Garden of Eden? That he was going to throw some temptation at the second Adam here, as the Bible says, talking about Jesus, and Jesus would just fall for it? If that's what he was thinking, he was very disappointed and very surprised. Because Jesus had determined that wasn't going to happen with me. He wasn't going to fall for the plan of the devil. He was going to expose the plan of the devil. He was going to expose what the devil is all about. The Bible has many names and many descriptions of what the devil is, what his name means, and it describes him. One of the most interesting to me is for this word where it uses devil in this passage. It's a word, diabolos. That means, the verb root word of it. And I don't know Greek. I don't know how to speak it. I don't know how to read it. But from what I read and understand this week, that word that was used there meant divider, splitter, place a wedge. And it fits so much. This is exactly what the devil was trying to do. He was trying to drive apart the Father and the Son. Just like back in the Garden of Eden, when he came in, he separated Adam and Eve, mankind, from God by wedging in between them. And this is what he's trying to do here, is to force a wedge between the Father and the Son. This is such a pivotal moment in the life and ministry of Jesus. Jesus was establishing for all the world to know, and especially for Satan to know, I'm no lightweight. I'm no pushover. What you did to them won't work with me. He drew the line in the sand and said, this is not going to work with me. How did he do this? How did he trust in the Father? He trusted in God's promises. Every temptation, he responded back to the devil by saying, it is written. And that's just more than memorizing scripture. That's saying, I know what God says and I believe him. I know the promises and I believe them more than I believe the circumstances that I'm in. There's one more pivotal coming out event that I want us to talk about here for a few minutes. Jesus, shortly after this time, began his ministry, his public ministry of teaching and preaching and healing, performing miracles and traveling around the countryside. And the word about Jesus was already spreading, the things he was doing and saying and teaching and preaching. And one person comes to Jesus, and he's a Pharisee. And we're going to read about that in John chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. He says this, now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a member of the Jewish ruling council. He came to Jesus at night and said, and this is the first occurrence that we have of Nick at night, is when this took place. And he came and he said, Rabbi, we know you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you are doing if God were not with him. In reply, Jesus declared, I tell you the truth, no one can see the kingdom of God unless he is born again. Jesus and Nicodemus continue to have a conversation. We're not going to read all this, but they keep talking to through, and he's talking about coming to know the Father. And it's in this conversation that we have John 3:16 recorded. For God so loved the world. And that's what this comes out of this conversation. Now I'm going to come back to that, but I want to look over in the next chapter, another meeting that Jesus has with someone right along, very shortly after this. John chapter 4, verses 4 through 7. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, will you give me a drink? Now they go on and talk some more, and Jesus begins to take this conversation to a spiritual side of things. And a few verses later, in verse 10, Jesus says this to the woman. He says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. The point I think that we can take from this is that Jesus established very early that he was going to point others to God. That he was going to point others to God. Think about this for just a moment. Two people that couldn't be any more opposite than these two. Everything was different about these two. One a man, one a woman. One a Pharisee, one a Samaritan, one who knew everything about all the rules and probably kept just about all the rules. and one who had lived her life footloose and fancy-free and broken all the rules. Said she'd been married 5 times and was living with the 6th man now. They couldn't have been any different. But what did Jesus do? He pointed both to Jesus. Right out of the box, Jesus let the world know that nothing or no one was going to stop him from pointing people to Jesus Christ. It wasn't going to be Jewish customs. There wasn't going to be gossiping, wagging tongues. It wasn't going to be the threat of violence. It wasn't going to be the threat of death. Nothing was going to keep him from pointing people to Jesus, to salvation, to God. Jesus broke the mold of what people considered a religious person of that day. He shattered it in the eyes of the world. He broke the mold. He got his hands dirty. He got down where it was messy. There was no one that was so low on the social status, whether it be lepers, whether it be sinful people, no matter what it would be, that he would not touch, that he would not talk to, that he would not go and share a meal with. And no matter how high they were on the political standards, on the ladder of success, there was no one that Jesus would not talk to and point to God. Jesus established right out of the box that I came for all people. Now, 3 events that I shared with you very quickly here. But what's the application for us? What's the application for us, for us modern day followers of Jesus? Those who want to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Don't want to be fans on the sidelines cheering Jesus on, but truly want to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, a follower who walks in his footsteps. Well, simply put, it is this. This is it. If we're going to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, then we have to make a bold statement with our lives. We have to draw the line in the sand. We have to say something with how we live and what we do and how we behave. And it's time to set a tone, to come out of the blocks, to draw that line, to choose sides. I read this week about a retired Marine who, when he got out of the Marines, he went back to school and wanted to be a school teacher. And he was a high school teacher. And his first job was going to be in a California high school. And some weeks, months leading up to when he was starting his first job, first day of school, he was in an accident and he had to wear, injured his back severely, and he had to wear a brace, a plaster brace. You couldn't see it because he could wear it under his shirt and it fit tightly against him. You couldn't see it, but he had to wear this brace. And he had been thinking about what could he do, that going into this new class and the kids were going to know that he's a new teacher, ex-Marine, what's he going to be like, what can we get away with, you know, the whole deal, how you try new teachers, you know how we did. Well, he walks into class the first day and doesn't know exactly what he's going to do, but the window is open there in this California high school, the fan is blowing, and as he sat down, his tie blew across. And he thought, he took the tie, straightened back up, picked up his stapler, and stapled his tie to his chest. Never had any problems with discipline. He set the tone right out of the blocks. He said, this is who I am. And I'm telling you, people, it's time we make a statement. It's time that we make a statement, a bold statement with our lives. And how do we do that? Well, Jesus showed us. We do the same things that he did. The first thing is just obey. Be obedient. Obey him. Obedience is more than just following a list of rules and being able to say, well, I did that, and I've done that, and I'm this, and then checking it off, and at the end you can say you're done. It's not about being able to say, I did all of these things, so I'm better than you are. And when we're compared, I'm up here and you're down here. And I always do things better than you. It's not about that. It's not about being obedient to the point that you can say, I have kept all of your commands, God, so when we get to the end of our lives or we're about to face some type of trial or tragedy in our lives, that we can say, you owe me, God. You owe me. I did everything I was supposed to. And the older I get, the more I'm convinced that that's a real temptation, is that we live our life and we follow and we try to do everything right, and we get to a point where something bad happens and we say, but God, I thought I'd done everything right. God doesn't owe us that. He's given us salvation, but he doesn't owe us to escape any tragedies in our lives. Obedience is about being in step with God. Obedience is about saying, I'm a part of God's big story, and that's where I want to be. It says, I am in harmony with God. Still, obedience is so far from the mind of too many Christians. You got to remember what Jesus said in John 14. He said, those who keep my commands, they're the ones who love me. To love me is to obey me, he said. I could go around this room or any church in America, probably in the world, and I could say, do you love God? And everybody would say, yes, we love God. Do you going to obey him? Yes, we're going to obey him. But if we had that truth helmet that we could put on, that everybody had to slip that helmet on, and no matter what you were going to say, you tell the truth about that truth helmet. And I asked the next question, said, well, are you going to obey him at work tomorrow and at school? And no matter what we went to say, I'm afraid too many Christians, what would come out would be, I have no intention to. You want to make a bold statement in your life? You want to set the tone for your life? Then obey him. You see, we can blame it on the economy. We can blame it on the president. We can blame it on the school we attend. We can blame it on our parents and how we were raised. We can blame it on our friends or lack of friends. We can blame it on being lonely and a thousand other things. But we cannot escape the fact that Jesus said, if you love me, you will obey me. Begin with making a bold statement in your life of being obedient to him. Second thing we can follow that Jesus did is we can say we're going to trust. We're going to trust God. We're in the middle of just basketball frenzy right now. It's one of my favorite times of year. All of the college basketball that's going on and the tournaments that's taking place. I love that time. A couple of weeks ago was the ACC tournament. And if any of you watched that, you remember that there was one of the best players on one of the teams. Just as he was coming down the lane, he was driving to the basket, and as he was up in the air, he got fouled and it knocked him off balance. And as he went down, he just innocently put his hand out to catch himself. And when you watch it on replay, it just looks like his hand just a little bit. He hadn't played in another game so far. And I thought about that. You know, that's what we do. You know, I'm not faulting him. If I'm going to fall, what I'm going to do? I'm going to try to catch myself. The truth is, we get hurt a lot more by catching ourselves than if we just went on and fell. The wrist is one of the weakest joints of the body. And I thought about that from a spiritual angle. It's when we try to catch ourselves that we end up weak and hurt instead of falling into the arms of Jesus. Trusting him in situations that don't make sense here, but we trust his word and allow him to catch us. Now, I realize that obedience and trust are very close to each other, but they're not the same thing. So you can strictly obey God. You can be obedient and check that list off and not trust him. Because there's too many of us who trust in being good and keeping all those commandments and keeping all those things, trust that more than we trust the grace of Jesus Christ. That's what's going to save us. And we trust in what we can do and not in what he can do. You can trust God. You can. During World War II, that fire General George Patton. The war and some of the annals of it records that he was in a battle with Field Marshal Rommel of the German army, a great general. And Rommel had attacked But Patton had counterattacked. And everything that Rommel went to do, Patton was already a step ahead of him. And he was counterattacking. And he was always a step ahead of Rommel. And it's recorded that during in those war rooms when they would plan out their next moves, that Patton said out loud, "I read your book, Rommel. I read your book." And what he meant by that was that Rommel was such a great general that he had written of his battlefield exploits. And he had written about what he does in certain situations. And Patton had read his book. And he said, "I know what you're going to do before you do it." We can trust God because he's read Satan's book. He knows what he's going to do before he does it. He didn't catch Jesus off guard. Jesus knew what he was doing before he did it. Why do you think he said, "Turn these stones into bread," because he knew he was hungry. Jesus knew that. He knows what your weak spots are, and believe me, we got them. But we can trust God that he already knows what Satan's doing and that it's a trick. And we can trust him and trust those promises that says even I'm hungry, when our heart and our mind, our body says I'm hungry, but God says, "I don't eat that way." That we can trust God. He knows what he's talking about. When you're lonely, you're out there in the wilderness all by yourself and you feel like nobody else is there and you say, "I could not be alone if I'm with him or her." But you see that God says, "That's not the person you need to be with. That's not the type of person and the habits and the way you need to be living." That you trust him and said, "God, okay, I trust you. I'd rather be alone here, but trust you." You can trust God because he already knows what's coming. You can make a bold statement in your life by trusting him and the people around you seeing that you have placed your trust in God. We also can point others to God. We can point. Simply put, if you aren't pointing people to God, then you aren't doing your job. There's no other way to say that. Scarier than the fact that we're not pointing people to God is the fact that we're pointing people somewhere. Somewhere we're pointing people to. In Matthew 5:14, Jesus was talking to his disciples and he told them, he said, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden." Would you let that sink in for just a second? A city on a hill cannot be hidden. You can't build a mighty city, place it on a hill, and expect it not to be seen. If any of you have ever traveled out in the western part of our country, and you get out in Las Vegas and California, and you're driving along and you see the lights of a city, you say, "Oh, that's just right down the road." You can drive for an hour or more and not get there because you can see the lights of that city from so far away. And Jesus is saying the same thing. You can't build a city and hide it. No more than we can hide our lives. We're pointing somebody to somewhere. And we need to be aware of that fact. Just this week, I was here towards the end of the day before I went home, and a pickup truck pulled in beside the office. I could tell that they didn't know, weren't familiar with our office and stuff because they went to the back door. So I walked around to meet the young man there. And they were from down at Aurora working there. They were from, he was a worker had come in, I think, from Texas, he said. And they were trying to get to some place, and they'd gotten turned around, got some wrong direction. I said, "Oh, man, you're going to have to go back here and do this and stuff." And so he mentioned something about the church here. And we started talking a little bit. And the driver was still in the truck. And he said, "Yeah," the guy says, I don't know him. And he said, "We're just contract workers that have been brought in from different places." And he said, he was just telling me as we was riding up the road that he used to be in some really bad stuff, but he's given his life to Christ now, and he's a Christian. I said, "That's great, man." And then he had a puzzled look on his face, but he said, "But I don't know." He tells me that, but then he gets on the telephone, is talking to somebody, and he's using a cuss word here and a curse word here, and he was just saying blank this and blank that and blank all this. And the puzzled look on that young man's face, I just can't forget. He said, I don't know. He said, if he said he had changed his life, but then he talks like that. And my heart broke. What could I say? We're pointing people somewhere, either towards God or away. And our question is this, our decision is this: what's stopping you from obeying God? Is it a habit that you have that you enjoy just too much to let go and you just can't obey? Is it, what's keeping you from trusting him? Is it something that's just stopping you from trusting him? Is it a selfish desire that you have that you say, I want these things in life, and if I listen to God, I can't have them, and I just can't trust that I'm going to be happy unless I have these things and do these things and go these places, and I know I shouldn't go, but God, I just can't trust you. And what's keeping you from pointing others to Christ? Are you like the young man who was driving the pickup truck? Is it your language that keeps you from pointing people to Christ? You want to, but then that's just so inconsistent. Is it the bitterness you have in life or towards someone that just spews out? Is it the attitude at work? Is it the unforgiving spirit that you can't forgive, and people see that and they say, well, if I don't know about you, if you say you're forgiven, but you won't forgive me. What's going to stop you from inviting somebody to worship with you every single week? Every single week, just inviting somebody to come to worship with you. What's going to stop you this week for taking that paper or saying, you know, I'm going to ask so-and-so, and I'm going to ask these three families to come to church with me Saturday night and watch this movie, because, man, they need to see this. What's going to stop you? Set a tone. Make a statement with your life that I'm not going to let this happen anymore. The first place you can start that is right here. If you're not a Christian, what a bold statement you say to those around you, to the world, to Satan himself, to God in heaven, that when you walk down the aisle and say, I give my life to you, please forgive me. You know, baptism, coming forward, they do so many things. I mean, it does so many things for us. But what a bold statement to walk down in front of a couple hundred people, to give your life to Christ, go into a baptistry, get soaking wet, and you're the only one that gets wet. That's a statement. That's a statement to the people out here that says, nothing's stopping me. Bad hair day, floppy white gown, nothing stopping me. That's a statement. If you're satisfied with your life just floating along and not making a statement to the people around you, then just keep going the way you are. But if you're ready to make a bold statement, then step out, obey, trust, and point. Let's stand together and sing.